you want to make comments. I mean, I certainly think this is the last opportunity of these events where we're going to have a chance to talk about some of the things that happened. And maybe we'll start with a few questions from Alex and a few to talk about some of the stuff that Alex has been talking about tonight, and then we'll have a chat about some of the other issues. But we're definitely interested in what people have got to say about some of the things. We're not quite sure what direction to take about some of the events that happened this week. But anyway, we'll start with anybody who's got any questions for Alex.
Yeah, sort of thinking about everything you were talking about earlier, how much evidence of that are you seeing in the like official kind of abolition stuff? How much of this is getting touched on at all, if any?
Well, it's some of it. I mean, there's mentions of Olo de Requiano a lot. Say, like I haven't kind of been participating in loads of events, but I've checked out some websites and read articles and they've come up, and I think, I mean, Olo de Requiano gets mentioned quite a bit in passing as a kind of example of a black abolitionist. I mean, the idea of how much kind of resistance from within slavery got to change slavery doesn't seem to have been covered much from what I've seen. But I mean, I wouldn't have expected it. That's why events like this have to be put on. I think, I mean, there's an ongoing myth of history of that like, despite all the work that people have done over the years to kind of try and examine history and talk about history as like different, you know, different experiences and different ideas, and people have different interpretations of history, and these interpretations can be, you know, debated, whatever. There's just still this kind of received myths that everyone is taught, and that is what comes out in whenever these kind of celebrations or events come out. It's always this kind of, in 1780 whatever, Wilberforce got involved, decided to abolish slavery, and in 1807 slavery was abolished. Whoopee! And that still gets repeated. I mean, kind of, there's plenty of people beavering away saying that's not the case, I think, in websites and meetings, but in kind of general, the kind of mainstream, it's not happening. But that's kind of par for the course.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to make a quick comment about that. I don't know, there's a programme on Radio 4 called In Our Time, which is well on Thursdays in the morning. It's one of the few programmes on the radio where they actually do discuss history sometimes. And it's a bunch of intellectuals sitting around a table with Melvin Bragg sort of trying to get them to explain things clearly to dumb people like me. So I do watch that. I have listened to that on the radio. And the other week, I was absolutely shocked by what happened. I don't know if you heard it, but normally they all sit in a studio and they have this debate about, you know, whatever part of physics or something, a bit of history or something. And they had this thing about Melvin Bragg decided to take the programme over and make it a special programme where he would run the programme. He would go and talk to various intellectuals about William Wilberforce. And I was astounded when I heard the programme because, I mean, he tried to do, although he did have a few people like Madge Dresser and a few other people comment on it, he tried to rebuild Wilberforce's reputation, which he said had been attacked. And basically, as far as we can work out, like Melvin Bragg did this on the basis that he was a Christian, or he's writing to these Christians. And that's great. I mean, I've not really a comment on the Christian bit of it, but he really tried to rebuild Wilberforce, saying that Wilberforce had a terrible time. And they quoted Eric Williams, who's like, I think, was he a prime minister or something in Jamaica?
Jamaican
radical historian. Yeah, radical historian, but I don't know, he had some role in the government or something. Anyway, and they quoted him as saying, oh yeah, wasn't he terrible to Wilberforce, the way he described him, you know, and it was like, how nasty he was. We're also thinking, like, no disrespect, but history's not about people being, like, a bit nasty. It's about the history, right? And I couldn't believe it, because I don't think Wilberforce, you know, has had a bad press, really. He might have had a bad press amongst a few historians and possibly amongst a few lefties, but he hasn't had much of a bad press in my experience at school. I didn't have my teacher stand up and say, well, you know, Wilberforce is portrayed like this, but actually, you know, he was a bit of a reactionary. He didn't believe in democracy. You know, he didn't believe in emancipation, really. He wanted slaves to be educated to be people who would be subservient, so they wouldn't, you know, that was never said to me at school. So it's all, you know, I was astounded. I don't know whether we heard that programme, but it was unbelievable at the end when you heard, like, Melbourne say, oh, you know, it's been terrible how he's been treated and all this, you know. And I was thinking, Well, you know, I mean, Wilberforce, as far as I can work out, you know, went to Parliament a lot, sat around with a bunch of evangelicals on Hampstead Heath or somewhere, wherever it was, and didn't do much. I mean, at least Clarkson, you know, travelled 60,000 miles around the country on a horse and spent 60 years of his life trying to build an anti-slavery movement. Wilberforce did nothing, as far as I can tell, right, in terms of actual, you know, and let alone the people who actually suffered and rebelled. I mean, the people actually fought and, you know, died and were flogged and hung and all that. And they were back in like 2007 hearing this like idiot intellectual on Radio 4 trying to stand up for him. Anyway, that's my
point. You made your point. You
well,
yeah.
Your point. Yeah.
You're not allowed to phone into Radio 4, I don't think that would come
well, that, or phone in like to Melvin Bragg and give him some jip or something. But, I mean, you know, anyway, that's just to give you an idea that even now, there's still like revisionist sort of histories going on, you know, or yeah, Melvin Bragg's had a bit of a bad time. Yeah, Wilberforce had a bad time, Melvin Bragg says he's alright now. Isn't, oh well, let's just forget it.
But is there not some like blockbuster film coming out with Wilberforce played by
amazing disgrace?
Bloke who plays Mitch, what is it, Hornblower or whatever? It's going to be his heroic struggle to kind of end slavery.
If you imagine, they've got a website. There's a really good link to an article by Peter Linebaugh called "Amazing Disgrace," which actually demolishes the film. But, so yeah, please look on the website. That article is really good. I think we'll be whacking something up in the next few days about that. So. Anyways, it's one here and then one.
I was just going to ask, did you complain to the BBC after the Points West came to see you about all the work you've been doing, and then they publicised the film as a kind of, if you want to learn more.
Well, actually, to tell you what happened was, we didn't see it until the next day, and then we strutted around the room screaming and shouting at the telly, in fact. But,
yeah.
You know, we were very angry about that, but they said absolutely nothing about putting that into into the item. And, you know, I know what the media are like. I know what the media are like, and you can't trust them, and they'll do what they have their agenda, obviously. But, you know, just to say to anybody who saw that, we had nothing to do with that, and we would not have done it if we'd have been associated with that film. Anyway, that's something. We want to portray it. We want to publicise the Seven Stars as a good bit of history in Britain, a good bit of the history. And we want to publicise all the history, but we feel that also that, you know, not only is the bad side of the history and, you know, slavery, you know, repressed in Bristol, but also, you know, some of the good aspects of it are also repressed as well. And we wanted to just make the Seven Stars, you know, bring its profile up. So, and we were completely fitted up on the PGC. So, anyway. Surprise. Anyway, surprise. Sorry, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I can ask you, why do you think slavery ultimately was abolished?
I think it's partly because of economic reasons and partly because of resistance. I think that groundswell of resistance that was coming up did make people think twice about it as an institution, make slaveholders think as an institution. But I do think it was just clearly not working economically, and that they cut and, to some extent, plantation owners cut and run, and kind of. I mean, but then it didn't happen overnight. I mean, it was like things took like many years to kind of filter out. Anyway, I mean, people were still being, even after slavery was actually officially abolished, like in the 1830s, people were still being illegally like worked as slaves. And like, but I think generally the climate just became. People can see that you work. I mean, free labour was just more economical and easier to control than people who were just getting too out of control to carry on working. That's, other people might disagree with that.
I mean, I think this week what we tried to bring up was some of the, you know, the you know, I think I talked last night a bit about nice and nasty people and moral things. I mean, I think this week we were trying to get beyond all that and talk about these military, political, and economic things that happened. And why it was abolished. I think what Adam, you know, one of the bit of histories that Adam Hochschild brought up last Thursday was really important, and that was the campaign by the British Army and Navy against the rebel slaves in Haiti in the 1790s, which taught the British Army and the British, this British establishment, if they were going to get into a fight against rebel slaves or a revolutionary situation in their own colonies, that fight would be bloody, it would be long, and it would probably be unsuccessful in the long term. And I think they learned a lot from him. Nobody's talking about that. I've not heard a single word other than Hochschild about those events, those 5 years of blood, which really taught not only the army and the navy that they were in for a long and bloody fight, but also the establishment in Britain that really, you know, if they wanted to hang on to the Caribbean, then they were going to have to change things. So, I mean, I'm totally cynical about it. I mean, the first time I actually read anything about the more economic side to it was when I read a book called The Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James, which is out in the bookstore, I think, which is about the Haitian slave revolt. And he writes this brilliant bit in, right near the start of the book, where he writes, he's got transcripts of the discussions that Pitt had with his own, you know, his own prime minister, and with the government and all this, and, you know, how they're thinking about how they're going to bring this change about. And they've got to kind of convince these right-wing slave-owning lobby in Parliament, but they've got their own reasons for doing it. And they've kind of, you know, C.L.R. James has got that information and said, okay, I don't think the British did it because they were nice, because basically, you know, they had slavery in the first place, and they weren't very nice people. You know, and these people were well happy with that system carrying on, but what they worked out was that they could do better economically, they could smash the French in the Caribbean as well if they got rid of the slave trade. And why that would work is because the French colony of Haiti, this is prior to the revolution in Haiti, was the most important colony in the world. Right? I didn't realise that. I mean, I thought Haitian slave revolt, I'd read about it a couple of times before. Yeah, that's good, you know. Well, that's good. But I didn't realise that we were talking about a revolution like in Haiti in 1791. Which was the equivalent of the whole British Caribbean. This island produced more wealth than, by a factor of two, than the whole of the British Caribbean. It produced more wealth than the whole of America. So this place revolting had a massive impact on European trade. When it was producing something like 35% of the gross national product of France or something. You know, it was a major, major band. It really resounded around. You can see why the British thought, well, we'll get stuck in and grab it. And that's what they did. They went in to grab it, and French slave owners waved them in and said, come and help us, because we've lost the island. You know, so there's this weird situation with a war with France, but these French slave owners inviting the British forces in to try and suppress the slave revolt. And that bit of history is really important. I think it taught the British establishment and people like Pitt that really things have got to change here, and we're not going to, you know, and British commanders came back at Hochschild, documents in his book, Bearing the Chains, and said, you know, if you don't do something about this, you're going to lose the lot, and you'll lose all your possessions in the Caribbean. So I think, and that's just one part of a wider history, and C.L.R. James talks about this, and I think that's really important. So it's a kind of economic, political, military thing going on in the Caribbean, and different sides are jockeying for power and control over the Caribbean, and they're trying to work out the best ways of getting round the problems they've got there. And the British, I think, historically have been, the British Empire has been pretty successful in getting around those problems.
Well, they're ultra pragmatic. The lead always led the world in kind of recognising where their interests lie, and are ultra pragmatic and like cutting and running when and introducing innovation and when it's needed, and pacifying rebellion as well. I think there's a very clever continuation of kind of minds there in a way. Yeah. But there was C.L.R. James had a theory that Pitt wanted to abolish slavery even before the Haitian revolt, because it would have undermined Haiti status.
Well, that's why you can see the way the British reacted. C.L.R. James said that what was happening was that Britain was getting slaves from Africa, and they were selling them to the French, right? We were actually selling loads of slaves. These British slave owners were taking people from Africa and selling them to the French. And the problem with that system was is that the French were putting them onto Haiti and building up a huge slave population, which is a minimum 500,000 slaves, possibly 700,000. And they were creating vast amounts of wealth for the French Empire. So the French were benefiting, and these British slave owners worked out that it was on the wrong end of it all. It was like supplying the French with slaves, and they were making huge fortunes. What the British thought was, well, if we cut off this supply of slaves, right, this is what Pitt was discussing, and they needed somebody to bring a bill in that would do that, and they talked to Wilberforce about doing it. mean, they couldn't do it up front because it was like Tony Blair thinking, oh, I need to get this policy in. I don't want to piss off all these people who are in my party or in these big business people, so I'll get some backbencher to do it. I'll get this backbencher type who's a bit of a troublemaker to bring in this bill, and then I can appear to all my rich friends that, well, it wasn't me, you know, whatever, he's got, you know, he's a man of conscience, you know. So they actually engineered a lot of this. They weren't, you know, Pitt was clearly involved in these sort of discussions. And what they wanted to do was stop that trade, right, which some slave owners, as Richard Hart pointed out, were quite happy with, because it would damage their competitors. And at the same time, they'd knock over the French. And then, unfortunately for the British and the French, who should step into the breach but the Haitian slave revolt? The slaves themselves stepped in and did it anyway. And suddenly the whole situation changed, and the British went, right, let's get in there and take it. And, you know, and the British Empire threw itself in there and got defeated and left, and then thought, well, maybe it was right. Maybe our strategy of stopping the slave trade was right in the first place. So that history, I haven't heard anybody talking about that, and that's absolutely vital to understand the whole period of the abolition of the slave trade. And then obviously Richard Hart talked a lot about the next phase, getting rid of slavery, and how that rebellion in Jamaica in 1831 was so vital in, well, it finished it off, you know, I mean, that slave revolt. So we got two massive slave revolts, Haiti, the biggest and the most successful, 10-year war, I think, until they defeated everybody, and then this other one in Jamaica, Sam Sharp, you know, I mean, Sam Sharp, I think, is a big hero in Jamaica, but if I really had I'm not writing for statues, but I'd love to see Sam Sharp in Bristol, a statue of Sam Sharp in Bristol, that would be proper. You know, that's the kind of thing we really want. I mean, Clarkson's a bit of a halfway house, really, but I think Sam Sharp would be great. You know, that's my dream.
Sam Sharp Hall, then?
Sam Sharp Hall, you know. Imagine trying to get that one. So anyway, he's this rebel slave. But I think that's what I think. I mean, if you really want to put that bloke, Sam Sharp's probably one of the figures, isn't he, that you would put.
One thing we discussed with the history group in London, which we were thinking of doing, was actually gorilla statuing. Was actually making our own statues and going up and putting them up, like kind of just get, like, unofficially, because obviously, I mean, 90% of the people who get statues are like people that you wouldn't spit on if they're on fire, basically. But then we've got all these people from history who like who deserve commemoration, and like, I mean, we're certainly gorilla placking and gorilla statuing, we're kind of talking about just going on. We did in Southwark in South London a few years ago, about 10 years ago, we did some gorilla placking, which we just made some plaques out of wood with stuff laminated on about things that happened or individuals from that area, and we just went around and stuck them up with this epoxy resin type thing to the walls, basically all over, kind of loads of them all. Like, some of them stayed up for about a day and some of them stayed up for like a year or something. I think things like that, I mean, a gorilla statue, you know, go and make a thing out of fire, I don't know how you get someone to make it, and then just kind of put a plinth and put it in the middle of town, and it'd be quite fun.
I'll sound a light man did something similar for that bloody Festival of the Sea thing, I think it was at the Matthew celebration, and he's not here now, where's Hoggy gone, but they went down to the docks and put a statue up, like, which they thought was part of an art exhibition, but was a statue of a slave, you know, which didn't go down too well at the time. But I think, you know, so I mean, I think it's a good idea anyway. Sorry,
cool.
Sorry, I shut someone up then. Was it something to say? Something?
No, I was just going to say, if you pretend that Banksy did it, the council probably did.
Yeah, Banksy commissioned that. Oh, that's all right. Paging.
Yeah, the moving on a bit from the abolition of the slave trade, I mean, looking at the 1833, the abolition of the slave movement, how much of a bonus to that abolition do you think the riots in Bristol 1831, the sort of pro-reform riots of Bristol 1831, how do you think that affected or had any effect on the abolition of slave movement 2 years later?
Well, I'll just say something very brief. That was a question that was asked last year by Natasha in the Bristol Radical History Week, and at the time I looked blank and went, I don't know. And other people went, or maybe there was kind of a wave of struggles at the same time, because what happened was, we were talking about the 1831 Reform Act riots in Bristol, though I would put Reform Act riots in big big exclamation marks or whatever, because that's a judgment on the riots that happened in Bristol. But she asked a question. 1831 seemed like a big year, you know. A lot of things happened. There was a massive rebellion, in, you know, Sam Sharp's rebellion in Jamaica, and there was also the 1831 Reform Act as well. It's very interesting because Adam Hochschild's book, he makes reference to the fact all the way through that not only did slaves, like Alex said, get information from sailors who were coming into the ports. I mean, the Haitian slave rebellion, it's reputedly said, was started by French marines, I think, maybe, or sailors coming off French ships giving news about the French Revolution and saying, you know, liberty, fraternity, equality. And, you know, and those ideas, you know, were part of certainly people's slave rebels in Haiti. Haiti's, you know, part of their rebellion was about that. But also, Hochschild talks about the fact that all the way through these slave rebellions, all through the period, slaves were obviously, they were, first of all, they were house slaves. They were in the bloody dinners, you know, they sat there while all these abolitionists discussed, all these slave owners discussed abolition. And you imagine the slave owners, they were plotting the whole time and discussing all these issues, you know, what's going to happen. So people were aware, just from hearing stuff, that there was like abolition movements, and people became aware of figures like Wilberforce or whatever. But even more interestingly is that you get into the 19th century, you get all these Baptist missionaries going out there and teaching, you know, people started to learn to read and write. People could read newspapers. Mm. And there's a big reference that in the 1831, you know, there was all this trouble around the country. There was basically class war in Bristol, as far as I can work out. But there was also a big push for reform. There were these
riots in London as well.
Nottingham, yeah. We heard about a week ago, and some people from Nottingham came down. Derby, there was like sabotaging factories. And there was a major movement in 1831, of which the most bloody and, you know, the biggest uprising was in Bristol. Now, very, very interesting that Sam Sharp's rebellion should happen, and the riots in Bristol were at the end of October 1831. Sam Sharp's rebellion kicked off in December, I think, around Christmas Day or something like that. Now, that's clearly plenty of enough time for some newspapers to get from London or from England to Jamaica. And apparently, there's references to the fact that people said that they thought, Jamaican slave rebels said they thought the British slaves were liberating themselves. The British slaves were liberating themselves. So there's comments about this. And so it's not surprising, I don't think it's surprising that you know, a lot of historians have drawn these links and said people launched, slaves in Jamaica and the Caribbean launched rebellions when they thought abolition was coming. And Sam Sharp, as Richard Hart said, they plotted together and they told people they were free. And it was only the slave owners who were keeping it secret. So there was information travelling back and forwards, and it probably had a direct link. I mean, it would be really interesting to try and find that link, because that would suggest that, you know, the riot in Bristol in this very city may have triggered another rebellion somewhere else, which, you know, probably ended the slavery in the British Empire. So, I don't know, there's a lot of work to be done, isn't there?
Or vice versa.
Yeah, or vice versa, yeah.
I just come up with an idea, actually, because I'm involved. You know, I was involved in the Ducie Road Mosaic.
Yeah.
Our next project is the Lawrence Hill Bridge. We're going to put enamel plates onto the between the there's blocks of rivets and things. There's 11 panels we can do, and I could do one on Sam Sharp.
Yeah, you should do one. That'd be brilliant.
Just
to explain, this is to do with Barton Hill Cotton Works. I think we were talking about the other day.
That's right. We've done the mosaic on Ducie Road.
Big murals that. Probably a little bit more explanatory about the history of Barton Hill than something the council might whack up. Does anybody want to say anything about this Colston Hall thing? I think we know the Evening Post held a poll or something this week about whether the Colston Hall should be renamed, and immediately people started writing emails to us saying they wanted to rename it Clarkson Hall, or, you know, after Thomas Clarkson. Some people said we should call it Thomas Clarkson Hall in case it gets, no, you know, they get confused with Jeremy Clarkson. They're a nightmare.
Oh, God.
I mean, you know, I personally think, I mean, you know, Madge Dresser, I think, put an email in the other day. She's an academic at UWE saying, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't do this because, you know, it might cause a reaction in Bristol and we don't want to, like, but, you know, there's been some debate about it. I mean, personally, in the group, we would see the changing of the name of Colston Hall to something else as, I regard it as a victory, actually. I would, and I don't really care whether it causes a bit of trouble, because I think the problem with this city is that too many people have been trying to keep their heads down about all this stuff anyway. And I don't think people should be frightened about it. I mean, I think the whole point of us doing the Seven Stars thing is to say, you know, I was arguing with people about it at work. Because obviously, they were going, oh, yeah, can I get an autograph, you know. And I was just going, like, you know, this is just, this is nothing to be ashamed of, is it? I mean, the Seven Stars is something to be proud of. If you're going to be proud of anything, then that's probably something you might want to be proud about. So I think that, anyway, I don't know what people think about it. What do people think about that? Rename the Colston Hall. And that means we've got to do something about it. It means you've got to vote and convince the Evening Post, whatever that means.
Why didn't the academics want it?
They argued that Madchester argued that she said it's much more important that the history is uncovered and that Colston is like, her words, demolished historically, because obviously the merchant venturers, you know, and all these people will claim, and I've read some books, the little pamphlets they put about Colston in the museum, and they're all really like kind of, oh yeah, Colston, you know, he might have been a bit involved in the slave trade, but actually he was a really nice man, and he was nice things, and he gave this to this, and opened a little school there. Well, Madchester said, well, we've got to demolish that history, and actually we shouldn't, you know, she said it, a quote, her quote was, it's a bit Stalinist to try and change the name of the hall. You know, it's a bit like, oh, we mustn't, you know, we shouldn't remove his name, we should just take him apart historically. And I was like, I think that's rubbish. I think, you know, there's loads of Colstons all around Bristol. Colston Street, Colston School, Colston this, Colston that.
Surely the whole point, it's the whole point of renaming it, is to bring up
the
history.
It's a good way of demolishing something, isn't it? Taking the name away, anyway.
And I think we can win the debate as well.
Why you're actually doing it, then it's a really good way of doing it.
She also said that she was afraid that if you push for a total renaming, that you would, not to have it get going her, but she said she was afraid that it would unleash the, you know, like the violent racism of the white working class in the city.
Well, she said a white backlash. But I mean, personally, I think, you know, I don't think, you know, that's not a good reason for not doing it. I mean, the point about it is get debate, I think it can be won. I think the problem, personally speaking, I think the problem with the debate is about class in Bristol. It's about whether people, you know, associate themselves with a bunch of rich people in Clifton. I don't think they do. So I think you can win the debate. You can say these people have nothing to do with you. Colston's nothing to do with you. If you don't half a chance, you'd half of you in Jamaica anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's the point. And they did do that as well. They took people out of Somerset and they were used. They took them to the colonies, and West Africa was just a bargain basement for them that allowed them to get on with moving another load of people, you know, to somewhere else. So, you know, the point about, I think I would say about this is, if you can get the point across in Bristol that it wasn't everybody involved together, because it wasn't, it was a class of people who had organised it and made profits out of it. And I think it comes right back to today. You know, you can say to people, you know, what have you got in common with those people up there who want to protect their heritage up in Clifton, the merchant venturers? Most people have nothing in common with them, right? So we have to break that idea that it's white Bristol or something, which is rubbish. And I think actually it's not true. I don't think most people regard themselves as white Bristol. I think that's rubbish. I think you can fight it, and what you don't do is keep your head down. I don't know.
Anyway, I think that actions speak much louder than words. And the apology about slavery from the government, that actually united for the back of a bit of action.
Well,
do something, that would be something that could be done to actually...
The only way you could do anything like that, though, is by all these people that made money, tons and tons of money, when the slave trade was abolished, they circumvented all of these monies to be released from the government to pay them off for getting rid of their slaves, to pay them for getting shot on their slave. I mean, it's only those bankers, like Roger mentioned, the merchant ventures, all of those cronies. I mean, there are names there. The only way that it's going to be recognised if those people are forced to give up their luxury lifestyles and their, you know, and a lot of wealth, and actually give it back to the nations that were slaughtered and maimed and butchered, you know, for their lucrative lifestyles now. You know, it's just pointless. That's the only way we can get around that.
Investment in banks.
Yeah, Barings Bank, Rothschild, Barclays.
The names are out there.
Yeah.
I guess one of the big problems is the Evening Post, because they really, I mean, I've never seen a local newspaper that sets themselves up so much as like the voice of a place, you know, and it's just a foregone conclusion, whether it's about apologising for slavery or should we rename Colston, you know, the whole thing's a setup, and
it's the voice of the West, man.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Is that right? Bristol one.
And so there's definitely like it's a really important thing. How are you going to get round? Because you can't use the Evening Post as your own mouth. I mean, you can try, but it's really and so you've got to be your own mouth, and that's going to be a big thing. Is how you can mobilise yourself to reach people and then get that heard, you know.
I was thinking of using Massive Attack, because obviously most people know Massive Attack, I don't know, as people correctly refuse to play in the Colston Hall until it's until it may be renamed. So we were thinking of getting Massive Attack, say we'll do a gig at the Thomas Clarkson Hall, if it's renamed, right, to celebrate, you know, the end of, like, this bloody name, and it's rubbish it's associated with. Yeah, I mean, we know one or two people, but it'd be good if people had some contacts and just say this is a brilliant opportunity for Massive Attack to step in and, you know, cause some serious trouble in this city, and, you know, I think we get a massive support for it. Yeah, and there's also you know, Banksy as well. Banksy, I'm sure. Yeah, you can see that already. Massive Attack, Banksy, Portishead as well. Why not? Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, well, to put it bluntly, I mean, the thing with Massive Attack, I asked somebody the other day, you know, who's if you went around the world, and I'm talking about the last 200 years. Like who's the most well-known sort of artistic talent from Bristol? And somebody said Cary Grant. And I was like, well, yeah, maybe, no disrespect to those from Redland, but I was like, well, not really. I mean, you know, not now, is it? I mean, yeah, okay, he's quite well-known, but I mean, Massive Attack are massive. You know, so they won't play it there in their own city. I mean, that's an opportunity, isn't it, for all this?
I refuse to play at Colston for the same reason.
You refuse to play. No, fair, that's good.
I've seen your stand up.
Yeah, I've seen the result. So, well,
I agree with that. I think the argument says we won, to be honest. The people who vote in favour of keeping their own as Colston in Evening Post surveys tend to be, let's face it, the older members of our community, don't they? They're voting just because, well, you know, it's always been that way. Why should it change in political correctness? The arguments are there to be won, I think, and we should start.
Mm.
I do think that, I mean, it's not my city, but I would be interested to, I mean, Thomas Clarkson's all right, I think, as abolitionists go, but maybe it should be named after a black abolitionist.
Murder on the Piano Hall, yeah.
Who owns Colston Hall?
Well, I think the renovation's been done by the council, and I think they kind of could, well, I don't know, somebody correct me, but as far as I know, the council owned, yeah. Because they're doing a big renovation on it, so it's a big opportunity.
I mean,
they
were going to demolish it a few years ago, it was definitely on the card, and then we're going to backtrack.
I mean, the unions, for what they're worth, are fairly, you know, well represented within the council, so using the council link, you know, trying to get people on board within the council who might be on the side might be useful to an extent.
Duty reopen next year, so we might have this space for
another definite date.
I think the first thing people could do, I mean, I know it's, God, I don't even say this, but I mean, you know, write to the Evening Post. I mean, like, you know, write to them and say, you know, we want it a different name. This is rubbish. Like, you know, I don't. I'm not really asking people to write.
No, but you're right. You know, yeah.
I mean, it's not.
They started the whole ball rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
a petition certain areas where we live.
Well, there's a thing, there's apparently a petition on their website, is that right, I think, where you can vote on it, I'm not sure, but if you go, and look at the, broke the cube, if you go to their website, apparently you can vote, but I mean, I do think it's worth having a go, you know, just to start the ball rolling. They're probably, in our group, some of us are going to try and get some public stuff out there, like, you know, something like maybe Massive Attack to make a statement, but I do, you know, and the other thing, Madge Dresser, to defend what Madge Dresser says as well, I think, not on that issue, but she always says, you know, apologies are not enough, you know, that's just a way of obscuring history, right, so history's got to be out there in the open, I think that's really important as well, but this could be something where we could actually intervene and cause something to happen, and it might cause a lot of debate. You know, it might cause a lot of debate. And the question then is that people have got to be out there and up there willing to debate about it, and they've got to debate it in a way that's going to, well, I don't know, going to win. You know, I think it's, you've got to unify the city, so it means unifying people around certain ideas, like, you know, that we should celebrate abolitionists. Like, that's not a bad thing. We know all the limitations we've heard today and over this week, but it's not a bad thing that there were people who were abolitionists. We should also celebrate, in my opinion, the radical and revolutionary abolitionists, and particularly these people Alex has been talking about today, because, like, you know, they're not known about, you know, and that's part of that debate, isn't it? I mean, I think people will react to that as well. I don't think, you know, maybe it'll be a bad thing.
Can I backtrack a bit to some of the things we have discussed in, about changing names of places and so on, and apologies and so on? There is a unfinished business that is caused these problems. The question of compensation I brought up last week and has been discussed again this evening. That is the unfinished part of the business of ending slavery. Compensation was made to one of the parties involved, but not to the other part. Mm-hmm. And the other party is the party that actually created the wealth.
Yep.
It was their labor that created it. They were never paid for their labor. There was no inheritance from this nation of people to their offspring. No legacy. It went to other families. So that money is there. The compensation paid, it can be traced.
Yep.
The banks that profited from it, it's still there. If I was speaking earlier and I was saying the analogy, if you work for a year, and at the end of the year I come to your home and I take that money, I take it to my home, I build my mansion, when I die, my kids, my grandkids inherit it. It is there. You die, your kids and your grandkids are pauperized. Now, it's clear where the money went, so it can be returned. But compensation doesn't necessarily have to be in a monetary form. It doesn't. You can help out the descendants or the nations in many ways that they are now struggling. Jamaica, Haiti, it's all there, it's clear.
Mm-hmm.
So until that unfinished part of the business is settled, then an apology won't mean anything. Right?
Yeah.
My grandkids can be apologizing to your grandkids, but your grandkids living in poverty, while my grandkids living in luxury. Apology is not going to help them. So apology is good only if the other half of the unfinished part of the business is settled. And also, putting the proper names on monuments and buildings and so on, as heritage. We shouldn't demolish it because of a particular name on it. We should get the right name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, people won't agree to do that until that unfinished part of the business is settled.
Yeah.
I think that is the whole basis why we're still talking about these things and why we're struggling to have the right history put up front for
mm-hmm.
everybody to acknowledge and accept. Because we are still not acknowledging what really took place, who were involved, who benefit, and the other party that still has never been considered, especially when it is they who created all the wealth that we're not want to name this, that, and put stuff and all that. So I think that is one of the fundamental problems. It is going to be a very hard struggle. It's going to take a long time. Because it was an establishment then that benefited. It's the same establishment now.
Yeah.
It hasn't really changed, you know. And this is why it's an uphill battle. But until we can get that other part of the business settled, then some of the things we're trying to advocate is just a drop in the bucket. You know, it's like you're just covering, putting up superficially, just painting over the cracks in the wall. When the cracks are still there, the wall is going to crumble, the building, the foundation is going to crumble. You know, so that is one of the things we really need to see how we can properly address it to the government, to the establishment, really. Because until their minds turn around, their thinking change and they acknowledge and accept the reality, the real history, the hidden part of the history, then, you know, we're not really making real progress.
Well, I'd agree with that, I think. Mm-hmm. Do you want to...
Well, I mean, it's just important to keep in mind that this is, you know, the proposal to do something about Colston Hall is symbolic, right? But I think any kind of intervention, especially an intervention, you know, that the radical contingency would have to be more of a provocation than actually something that would get passed. I get a little worried about the whole, you know, Thomas Clarkson proposal, because I feel like that could be taken up by some very, you know, well-intentioned, polite group, possibly up in Clifton. That probably is going to be like, if the issue was ever, you know, put to, if that was ever an issue that was debated on, I feel like that's actually something that, you know, they'd go for. They'd name it Clarkson. Clarkson has already become somewhat of a minor celebrity. I mean, that's all part of, like, you're talking about. You celebrate a white abolition, you make it seem like, you know, that slavery is something we've already dealt with, so let's honor our heroes kind of crap.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, so if this is symbolic, then the kind of figure that we have to put forward is going to be something that they absolutely are going to reject. But the point would be to get some name, you know, like in general discussion. So maybe Sam Sharp, or maybe the guy who went with, the guy who was with Echiano, who ends up getting sent back, John Annis, the guy who gets sent back and he gets flogged to death, right? I mean, that guy didn't write anything. That guy didn't stand for anything. That guy didn't, you know, I mean, he didn't speak in front of groups of people and change people's mind. I mean, that, what happened to that guy? He's completely swallowed by history, right? He's flogged to death in the Caribbean. So, you know, I mean, maybe we'll get his name. Put his name on the hall. They're absolutely not going to honor him, but that's the point. The point is just to get that history getting talked about him, so, you know?
Yeah.
So people see that there's... I don't know. I mean, I think the point of this is to bring up questions that can't be answered nicely. The questions that can't be answered, you know?
Mm.
So, I don't know.
Well, I mean... To put it really bluntly, I know exactly why the person who put the email in said we should call it Clarkson Hall. That's because I'm going to be absolutely blunt about it. Why he suggested that is not because they're liberals, because he absolutely is not a liberal. He did that because the main worry that they see, and what Madge Dresser kind of picks up on, is I don't know, you see a few Tories a few months ago in Tory councillors talking about it, saying, oh, we don't want to go there with all this, you know, people aren't responsible now. You know, for, you can't make people responsible in the city now for what happened, you know, 200 years ago. And what they will try and do is the opposition will try and unite Bristol around the idea. And they will be uniting white Bristol. That's the plan, right? They will be uniting white Bristol. They'll make a few plays to, like, ethnic communities or something. But they are trying to unite white Bristol around the idea of being Bristolian, of being a person from Bristol, right? And that... Bristol doesn't need to apologise because we're not responsible. So why that suggestion was made was because that person is trying to split white Bristolians down the middle. Right? They're trying to split the reactionaries, the wealthy Tories and all these people up in Clifton who want to avoid all this, the 63 merchant venturers who do not want to deal with this, right? And all their cronies and the Tories up in the councils. He wants to split those people in half and say, well, no, actually... There were many white Bristolians who were involved in abolition. Many of the sailors who, you know, worked on slave ships were also forced labourers. And that's the problem. That's the dilemma we've got. I mean, there's no way you'd equate them. I mean, you know, but he's trying to divide. He's trying to break this idea that everybody's a Bristolian and everybody's kind of equal and everybody should make an apology together. That's bollocks, in my opinion. Right. Until you understand the history, and that's part of the history as well, then you ain't going to get around that one. And I think that's why Clarkson was suggested, but I reckon you'd recognise the problem yourself. I'd like Samuel Sharpall.
No,
yeah. But yeah, he's being pragmatic and he's trying to cause trouble for them. You know,
yeah,
why don't you want to...
Maybe it would be good to have a bloody struggle before the... Maybe struggle, not the right word, but yeah, before the decision was made, even if they did decide on Clarkson, we kind of convinced them, if, you know, because there'd be lots of people pushing some sort of kind of fairly liberal alternative.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we call ourselves radical, then we ought to be radical. And I totally agree with you. You know, there's so much precarious stuff going on all over Britain every minute, and we get more precarious as time goes on. You know that, I know that, you know, and we've been around a long time. And, you know, it's about time the kind of. Just did something a bit more.
And something that's not like arrestable or anything, you know. But as you push them, and that guy is definitely, you know, he's worth being, you know, being mentioned and talked about.
Yeah, there's definitely a need here to get the merchant venturers on the back foot as well, to force them into some sort of debate, to get them out, because they're so secretive, you know, they control what they say and they're only kind of wheeled on when they say what they want. And A, because it deals with this idea of who, say, is, you know, white Bristolians, who really reflects, you know, your history. Is it the merchant venturers?
Yeah.
Or is it, you know, Sam Sharp? And also for the idea of compensation, you know, we should be hitting the merchant venturers. You say, coming out and saying, what, you know, what role have you had in this? You know, where have you earned money? And because these are big issues, but we can make them local, make people think about them locally. And I think the merchant venturers get away with a hell of a lot because they don't get challenged really, you know.
One of our ideas this year was to get them to disband as a gesture to the abolition. You know, that would be a good start. They just close the organisation down. It's a load of rubbish, isn't it? And it's, anyway, yeah, Rich.
So it's two statistics that stick out from the past events on slavery. One of them was from Jim McNeill's talk that was in 1831 about the time of the Queen Square uprising. The 6,000 out of 104,000 people in Bristol had the vote before the Reform Bill went through. And then after the Reform Bill, it was...
It might have been...
up to 10,000.
Right, yeah.
And the second one was from Adam Hochschild's talk that said that in 1792 there was a petition put into Parliament to abolish slavery with something like 340,000 signatures on it, which was greater than the entire electorate of the British Isles. And so, I mean, you can't choose your family, and in those days you couldn't really choose your government, but in these days you can choose what organisations you choose to be a member of, and there are still 60 odd members of the merchant venturers.
And they're not poor.
And, you know, so the question of who should be compensating and apologising for slavery, then, you know, they've chosen to be a member of this organisation with a past deeply steeped in slavery.
What are they doing? There is a debate going on. When is it, Will?
It's next Saturday. We broadcast on BBC 1 on Sunday, 25th of March.
Where is it?
Down the on the feed, it's being filmed. But there's like a question time discussion that panel, which includes Raj Dresser, there's someone from Cumber who's on the panel, also a merchant venturer. So, and as far as I know, that's the only public... So
every
time they're
going to
be making any kind of comments about abolition this year.
What time's that on? When is it, Saturday?
It's being filmed on Saturday 24th. It's going out on BBC 1 on the evening of
25th.
That's 10 o'clock
in the evening. You mean they could have gone to
sleep?
It's still
fairly
around.
We'll have the information on our website, though, too, about the where's and when's and all that.
Yeah.
And the website information is just on the bookstall table. It's just the leaflet you should pick up.
Well, it might be something to go down and, you know, I mean, they're asking for questions for that debate. Now, I know why they're asking for questions for that debate, because they want to select, you know.
It's the same way it works for questions.
Yeah.
You've got to put your question in beforehand.
But, so can you just go down there then? Or can you just wander in and have a, you can't just do that.
Well, you need to email your questions. I've got the email address. You want to leave me there,
and then... We have put a few questions. We have suggested a couple of questions because we're trying to get in there to have our say. But other people can do that. We'll put it on the website.
You need to submit the questions and those inbox back. So
yeah.
You have to do it
for that. Anybody else say anything? Well. Just a couple of things before we finish. First of all, this is the last event, so we don't, as you know, and I've bored everyone's senses with this over the last couple of three things we've done, but we're not funded by anybody, we're not in any political parties, We're not funding anywhere. We don't have business people. We have nothing to do with any of that. We're completely independent, which is why we're poor. And so if you want to buy a book, that helps us. Or if you want to make a donation, that's great. I think, just to let you know, these events cost, the eight events we put on, I think, cost 300 quid.
Just under
300 quid, which is not very much. And probably wouldn't pay one council advisor on slavery for a way day somewhere. So Liverpool's on. But if you want to make a donation, all that, no money goes back to us as individuals, it all goes back into the next event. So, you know, I really appreciate the fact people have come along to them and, you know, participated. And another thing I'd like to say, and I think the group would absolutely echo that, we're not, you know, we might have a few big mouths in the group, and, you know, we might not have any history degrees between us, but you know, really think, like Alex said, that history, you know, and these things are very important. You know, they have a role in understanding, you know, the world now, and it, you can understand things that happened in the past. And without the history, we sometimes think we're doing things for the first time, or that we're kind of weird, but we're not weird, because we've got a big, big precedent historically in this country, and that goes for all of us here and all the places we've come from, whether we're Irish or we're from the Caribbean or whatever. British history is very, very interesting, and I think there's a lot more stuff that's got to be done, and we'll be trying to do it. But what that means is that everybody here, you know, if you want to get involved and you want to, I don't mean like, oh yeah, write us an email. I mean, if you want to do the research and you want to do something, then, you know, it might be just read a book and do a talk, then you should do it. I mean, we're none of us, I don't think, come from any of those sort of backgrounds where we've learned how to do public speaking, and personally, I don't think that's a big barrier for most people. I think if you want to do something, you read a book and you tell people about it, we will be really happy to put any of those talks on. You know, just write to us or meet us and do it. You know, because I don't think we'd rather be sitting up there, I think, a lot of the time. But I really think you should talk to people. If you know other people who are interested in doing research or they want to do something, then this is a forum, an opportunity to do it, which I think is not as intimidating as trying to go to a university or something. So that's one thing. But lastly, let's say thanks to Alex for coming down tonight. Anything else anyone wants to say?
Yeah, thanks Roger and Rich for everybody else as well, but, you know, putting on some really good events the last couple of weeks. Been really good.
There'll be some more stuff in May we're hoping to put together, so if you want to get involved in that, get in touch with us. Also leave your contact email and we'll send an email.
Yeah.
Let's get more drink.